Under the Golden Dome is supported by the Iowa Bankers Association. Bankers across Iowa are ready to help Iowans reach their financial goals to get them where they want to go. Learn about the difference of Iowa banks by following Iowa Bankers on Facebook and Twitter.
From Iowa Public Radio News, this is the weekly legislative podcast Under the Golden Dome. I'm John Pimble.
It's hard to believe that it's been a little over a month since this historic and really catastrophic flooding swept across western Iowa and our state.
In her office, Governor Kim Reynolds gathers Republican leaders and legislators about flood relief measures.
We just found out on Friday that we will be receiving $9 million in early release of emergency relief funding from the U.S. Department of Transportation Federal Highway Administration. And we received notice on Saturday that FEMA will be adding additional assistance available to public entities and nonprofits in 13 additional counties for permanent work, and that brings the total of that to 33 counties.
What makes this flood worse and ongoing are the breached levees in southwest Iowa. Water from the Missouri River continues to flow across these areas in Iowa and Nebraska. There are also levees south of the state that have breached.
And it is important and critical that the federal government take a look at this when it comes to levee reconstruction and improvement from a regional approach. And that's why on April 3rd, we hosted Governor Ricketts from Nebraska, Governor Parsons from Missouri. The Governor Kelly from Kansas will be joining us going forward. She was not able to make that meeting. It was in Council Bluffs, and it was a meeting with the Corps and FEMA.
The Corps, or Army Corps of Engineers, regulates the flow of the Missouri River through their dams. In March, as the snow melted and rain fell, the river rose and damaged dozens of levees. Repairing and or replacing all of them will be a long process.
We collectively expressed our united support for, again, a regional approach to levee reconstruction and improvement. We committed to meeting regularly to hold the Corps accountable. The next meeting, I think, is on the 26th. River management policy changes must improve flood control to protect people and communities. In addition to that, we also made it clear that temporary levee solutions must be considered part of the long-term solution.
To coordinate the many aspects of this flood, the governor has signed an executive order creating a flood recovery advisory board. She says it will help decide what to do and how to use funds from the federal and state level.
The flood recovery advisory board shall consist of up to 15 members. The governor shall serve as a member and chair of the advisory board and shall appoint up to 14 additional members, which shall include the chairs of the working groups established by this executive order.
As to how much funding the state can make available now,
I'm asking the legislature to make available $15 million from fiscal year 19 ending balance that will go to the flood mitigation fund for impacted communities to help with cost share for flood control infrastructure repairs, as well as immediate fixes to for community safety.
The governor will also ask for another $10 million from the next fiscal year for workforce housing tax credits to accelerate housing improvements in flooded areas.
I want to give businesses and communities the assurance that we are going to rebuild, we're going to do this better than before, we're going to be strategic about how we implement the recovery process, and we want them to know that the rebuilding starts now and everyone in this room is committed and ready to go.
Standing with her in this press conference are Republican legislators and leaders like Speaker of the House, Linda Uppmeyer.
The House stands ready to do what is necessary to help move forward in an immediate way and cheer you on as we keep moving forward in every aspect of our rebuilding here in this state.
Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitfer says the governor has the support from Republican senators.
We are proud of our conservative budget that has provided resources to help address a natural disaster of this magnitude. I also want to urge the U.S. Senate to quickly act to pass a disaster relief funding request made in the immediate aftermath of the flooding in western Iowa that was quickly approved by the president. Flood recovery is a bipartisan issue, and it's unfortunate that some U.S. senators chose to come to Iowa, tour historic flood damage, then days later return to Washington, D.C., and vote against the Iowans they just met.
Senator Whitfer is talking about a congressional supplemental appropriations bill. It helps with expenses related to natural disasters for this fiscal year. It started in January in the U.S. House of Representatives with a price tag of $12 billion where it passed that month. As it moved to the U.S. Senate, many amendments were added, and it is now at $13.45 billion. One of those amendments will help funding for Iowa, but Democratic U.S. senators say it doesn't include enough money for Puerto Rico's ongoing recovery from a devastating hurricane in 2017. During a procedural vote on this amendment to make it filibuster-proof, mostly Democrats voted no, stalling the bill. Since then, the Vice President of the United States, Iowa's U.S. senators, and Iowa's Republican legislators have used that vote as ammunition against Democratic senators coming to Iowa as presidential candidates, like Booker, Gillibrand, and Klobuchar. Governor Reynolds also urges action from members of Congress to move the supplemental appropriations bill forward.
We need Congress to act. They need to demonstrate. You know, we got the presidential declaration done. We said initially we believe it's $1.6 billion. I believe that's probably low, to be quite honest, when you look at the extensive damage done to the levees. And so we need them to provide these communities and these farmers and Iowa the certainty that the funding will be there as we move forward. And so this will help, you know, some of the short-term improvements so we can get people back in their homes and we can let businesses know we are rebuilding, we take this seriously, and we're gonna come back stronger than ever.
Republican Representative David Seek's district includes counties along the western border where large levees broke. During an appearance on our talk show River to River, Representative Seek says farmers lost some of their harvest that was stored in bins, which is not covered by insurance.
This river bottom, there was more grain out there than probably would have been out there. But, you know, we were coming off all this wet weather. We'd had a extremely wet last year, so we had the roads were already impacted, so they couldn't move a lot of grain. And they couldn't move any grain when they got wind that this was, you know, going to come so fast. So I think that played into this. As far as the crops go, I actually, you know, we had a lot of farmers that had soybeans and corn still in the field out there because they couldn't harvest before winter came, and there was just everything was so wet and there was so much snow that there were crops out there. I personally had 200 acres of soybeans, and after the flood, it's gone, so I no longer have to worry about harvesting that because once the water's gone over it, it's no longer harvestable.
Before the fields can be planted, debris has to be cleared, which requires a farmer to invest more money in the land to start again. Democratic Senator Jackie Smith's district is in Sioux City, near the flooded areas. Senator Smith says flooding is happening too often and that the issue of climate change should be considered when talking about flood prevention.
And we have a lot of examples of where the weather is just not what it used to be. The 500 flood is occurring every 10 years. So until we're willing to at least have that be part of the discussion, it doesn't have to drive all of it. I don't think we'll get long-term flood mitigation. And it's a tough conversation.
The biggest challenge right now is to stop the water from the Missouri River from continuing to flow across southwest Iowa. The Army Corps of Engineers say its first priority is to provide a temporary system, which will take a month or two, then tackle the large task of rebuilding the large levees. That process may not be complete for a few years. This is the Legislative Podcast, Under the Golden Dome, from Iowa Public Radio. I'm John Pimble. As the session is in its last month, at least likely to be in its last month, bills tend to go back and forth between the House and Senate. If a bill passes in one chamber but is amended in the other's committee or chamber, it has to go back and be approved with those changes. For example, an administration and regulation appropriations bill passed the House last week, but now it is coming before a 5-member Senate Appropriations Subcommittee, and it has changes.
There is an increase of $5 million for broadband grants.
Republican Senator Dennis Guth goes through the differences between what passed in the House and what the Senate is proposing. In some areas, the Senate reduces funding, but overall their administration and regulation budget is $3.1 million more.
And it provides an appropriation of $275,000 in three FTEs from the Gaming and Regulation Fund for the Racing and Gaming Commission, contingent upon the passage of a sports wagering bill.
FTE means full-time equivalent positions. Senator Guth goes through another increase in spending.
An increase of $647,000 and seven FTEs for the Insurance Division for Workers' Compensation and Insurance Fraud Investigations.
This catches the attention of panelist Democratic Senator Claire Selsey.
So there's seven additional FTEs, two are workers' comp, and one is insurance. Where are the, what are the other FTE positions going for?
They're all, I believe, well, one of them is for a prosecutor, but they're all to investigate insurance fraud, with two of them or three of them that would be specified for workers' comp, as I recall. And this is only to be a, I believe it's a five-year trial on here. It doesn't go on forever. It's just something we're going to try and see how this works.
So do they have to submit a report to us? I can't remember in the bill. Do they have to report to us every year, like what the cost-benefit ratio is?
Yeah.
Because in my research, I found that there wasn't that much fraud. So I'm hoping that that turns out to be true.
Right.
So thank you.
Yeah, I hope that's true, too. That came at the request of the Commerce Committee's chairman.
Yes, I realize that. Thank you.
The changes to this appropriations bill are approved by this five-member subcommittee 5-4. Senator Selsey votes yes, but the other Democrat on this panel, Rich Taylor, votes no. The bill will go before the full committee, then back to the House of Representatives. The Education Appropriations Bill is for higher education.
The Department of the Blind, Department of Education, College Student Aid Commission, Community Colleges, the Board of Regents.
Republican Senator Tim Kreienbrick is the chair of a five-member Senate Appropriations Subcommittee. They are looking at the Education Appropriations Bill. The House passed a version 2 weeks ago, but the Senate is now proposing to change it by spending less than the House. The budget overall is more than was appropriated last year.
This is an increase of $32.3 million. And a decrease of 83.8 FTEs compared to 2019.
For a total of $944 million. A little more money, but fewer employees. One area of growth is $500,000 for adult literacy.
For a workforce program, this is a new appropriation that I talked to Senator Walz about from the general fund to go along with the $5.5 million that is appropriated from the skilled worker and job creation fund. The money will be used to reduce the waiting list of the ELL adult class learners in our community colleges.
ELL, English Language Learners, sometimes called ESL, English as a Second Language, it makes $500,000 available as grants for community colleges. Democratic Senator Zach Walz praises this portion of the bill.
That was something that I heard about first back at home with Kirkwood Community College. We certainly have a lot of folks who are in our communities who would like to learn English, would like to be a part of the workforce, but for whom the inability to get off the wait list is a real barrier, and so I'm really appreciative of that appropriation, and I really hope that it'll be able to survive negotiations with the House.
One of the biggest areas of interest in this budget is about the Regent Universities, Iowa State University, University of Iowa, and the University of Northern Iowa. The House passed an increase of $15.9 million, but this Senate bill is $4 million less. Democratic Senator Herman Kornbach says it's inadequate.
Just to set the context, mid-year budget cuts over the last couple of years have cut the regents by $33.6 million. The governor's recommendation was not sufficient, but she did recommend restoring $18 million of that, a little more than half. The Senate amendment here would restore only about a third of that, $12 million. Now, what the Board of Regents have told us from the beginning of the session is that if we met the governor's very modest request for an $18 million increase, they would hold tuition increase to 3%. They also warned us that if we fell short of that, then they would need to make up the difference by further tuition increases. Bottom line here is to vote for the Senate amendment is to vote for a tuition increase at our three state universities. There's no getting around that.
Senator Tim Kreinbeck says he understands that some wish this budget was higher, but this is what is sustainable. Also, these may not be the final numbers.
You know what will happen is we'll get into negotiations with the House, and we will continue to stress our priorities, and I'm sure they're going to continue to express their priorities, and we'll have to come to some type of an agreement before we get out of here, whether it's April or May or June. But at some point, we'll have to come to some type of compromise before we get out of here.
Senator Kreinbeck says he is taking note of Walz and Korbach's concerns as the process moves forward. The bill passes this appropriation subcommittee on a 3-2 vote. It will be discussed in the full Senate committee before going to the full Senate chamber. Then it has to go back to the House, and the House may change what the Senate wants, sending it back. As it is now, the differences in this bill come down to $9.1 million. This is the weekly legislative podcast, Under the Golden Dome. I'm John Pemble. There is another bill in the legislature that directly impacts public colleges and universities.
It merely says that community colleges and universities cannot enforce policies that would restrict students, faculty, people on the campuses from being able to have a self-defense tool, a stun gun.
Republican Representative Matt Winschittle is the floor manager for a bill that already passed in the Senate. He is talking about stun guns, a handheld device that delivers an intense, painful electric response. They shock a person when the device is in contact with their body. This is not a taser, which shoots barbed electrodes connected to a wire to deliver a shock. These kind of stun guns were legalized in Iowa 2 years ago for people over the age of 18, but some public universities have banned them.
This is more geared towards looking at the problems that we're having at some of our universities and on some of the college campuses that we have out there. And I've got a whole list of articles and statistics I can go through, but again, I don't want to belabor the point. So this is about people being able to make the decision for themselves, choose to use one of these devices if they need to, if they want to, and be able to hopefully avoid having a tragic attack and or assault perpetrated upon them.
Democratic Representative Lindsey James proposes an amendment that would eliminate the bill and establish a study committee. It would report back to the legislature next January about campus security policies and criminal activity and whether or not more security or devices like a stun gun are required.
7 out of 10 sexual assaults are considered interpersonal violence, meaning it's an assault by someone who is close to you. Someone who you trust. 7 out of 10 times, it's with someone you would never think you need protection from. There is a dire need for increased campus prevention and support systems at our state colleges. But without this amendment, the bill fails to protect women who are roofied, women who can't afford to purchase a stun gun or choose not to carry a dangerous weapon, and it doesn't address the 7 out of 10 women who are attacked by someone that they trust, who that they would never think they would need protection from, that they would never think to bring a stun gun when they are with them.
Representative Winschittle says he appreciates the intent behind Representative James's amendment, but
the fact of the matter is we know these assaults are happening on our campuses. We know that there are acts of violence that are being perpetrated against innocent people. We need to give them the opportunity to address that firsthand. We need to be empowering these students, empowering these faculty, empowering the people that are at these institutions to be able to defend themselves. Is it going to be a one-size-fits-all that addresses all of the different attacks or sexual assaults that are out there? No. But this is at least one more tool in the toolbox to help those people potentially fend off that attack and not have that traumatic experience, not have that assault perpetrated upon them.
The amendment is voted down. Democratic Representative Mary Masher proposes an amendment that would still allow stun guns on campus, but not in university child care centers, university hospitals, or university sporting events.
I think about the fact that Jack Trice Stadium holds 61,500 fans. Kinnick can hold 69,250 fans. UNI's Unidome, 16,324 fans that could attend those events. I think about the fact that when you combine alcohol and sporting events, you can have a very dangerous situation. Right now, the NCAA's best practices for the NCAA championship competitions instructs a prohibition of weapons of any kind at these events. The U of I athletics game day policies currently prohibit all forms of weapons. A stun gun is a weapon. We should prohibit that from any of these campus events.
Representative Winschuttle says anyone who is intoxicated with a stun gun is already in violation of the law. He also says this amendment would maintain the status quo.
Folks, what this boils down to is the simple fact that we've got people that are going out living their life, and they deserve the opportunity to be able to defend themselves. Now, this is not guns. I know that I'm known around this chamber and around this Capitol for being the guy that's all about Second Amendment virtues. This is not guns. We are talking about devices that are meant to incapacitate somebody for a temporary amount of time so that person that is being attacked can get away and go find the help that they need.
Representative Masher offers another amendment that would prohibit a convicted felon from carrying a stun gun to a public university or event, and it receives support.
We often hear that minority party members' amendments aren't taken. I'll use this as a day to say, we're going to be bipartisan, Representative Masher. I'm going to ask the body to accept your amendment. I think it's an improvement to the bill, and I will personally go over to the Senate and advocate that they take it over there as well.
As the bill is discussed, Democratic Representative Phyllis Thede says she worries that potentially the 81,000 students at the Regent universities could own a stun gun if this bill becomes a law.
And there will be no control, as far as I'm concerned, if you have that many stun guns on campus. The reason why colleges prohibited this was because they saw the inherent problems that this could cause. Now, I will say this. I hope I am wrong. I would love to be wrong. I don't have a problem being wrong on this issue. But no matter how you vote today, this is going to be a struggle. Because we have now told the colleges and the universities, hands off, you can't make policies like this anymore. That's troublesome to me. I'm more concerned about that than I am anything else. We're telling them, you no longer can do this because the legislature knows better.
The bill has support from some Democrats, like Representative Kristen Sundy.
I think young women and men should have the ability to do that on a college campus as well, if that's what they think is safe, and I think we should trust them to make that decision.
As Representative Winschuttle makes his closing remarks, he says his two daughters will likely attend one of Iowa's universities.
And I want them to know that their first line of defense is themselves. They can't expect campus security to be right at their beck and call every 30 seconds. They can't expect that some of the systems that these universities and college have in place is going to protect them from these type of attacks. My children, your grandchildren, the 81,000 students whose lives are precious that are going to our universities right now, they need to be able to defend themselves. The policies that our universities and our community colleges have put forth that restrict our students from being able to have this tool, and yes, it is one tool of many that they can utilize, but those policies that they have put forth are not serving our students, our faculty. They're putting them at a disadvantage. They are flawed policies. And yes, it is incumbent upon us to tell them when they have flawed policies. We send them the taxpayer's dollar, and we expect them to do good things with it, and most often they do.
The bill passes with Democratic support 60-37. Because it has an amendment, it will need to be approved again in the Senate if it is to be considered by the governor to be signed into law. This is the weekly legislative podcast from Iowa Public Radio, Under the Golden Dome. I'm John Pemble. There have been many attempts over the years to legalize sports betting. This year, there have been many subcommittees and extensive discussion for and against. This week, when it came before the Senate chamber, it passed in 13 minutes. No debate, just one person speaking for it. 11 Republicans voted against the bill, but because 12 Democrats voted for it, it passed. Those who voted yes include Majority Leader Jack Whitfer and Minority Leader Janet Peterson. Next stop, the House of Representatives. Help for this show comes from our Statehouse reporter, Katerina Sestarik, also from Radio Iowa's Kay Henderson, and many helping moments come from the entire press pool at the State Capitol. This show seeks guidance and script editing from Iowa Public Radio News Director, Michael Leland. No better way to learn more about what isn't on the show than by going to our website, iowapublicradio.org, for more legislative stories. It's week 14. We're getting close to the final scheduled week, which is week 16 of this session. But how long will it really go? We'll let you know on our new episodes of Under the Golden Dome. They come out every Friday afternoon from your preferred method of listening to podcasts. Under the Golden Dome is a production of Iowa Public Radio.
Under the Golden Dome is supported by the Iowa Bankers Association. Bankers across Iowa are ready to help Iowans reach their financial goals to get them where they want to go. Learn about the difference of Iowa banks by following Iowa Bankers on Facebook and Twitter.